Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our diverse seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I'm facilitator for this program, Susan Franson. But since this is Iowa History Month, as well as Women's History Month, the programs that best serve this purpose are from Pat Schlarbaum. So I'll turn the rest of the show over to him.
And Lance Foster is here, a Tribal Historic Preservation Officer with the Bakroje, or Iowa Tribe. Let's welcome Mr. Foster, the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Iowa Nation. Welcome.
Herodapi, that means good morning in the Iowa language.
Once again, thank you. What was that one more time?
Heroda means morning, and P means good. Good morning, Herodapi.
Yeah. Has this been a new field of endeavor, of renaming for you, Mr. Foster?
No, actually, the USGS, Board of Geographic Names, usually sends out proposed name changes to the tribes several times a year, because they know that a lot of the names that are on the map either are derived from different native languages, or and it's across the entire United States, or they're names like Squaw Creek that there are thousands of them across the United States. They're not unique. It's like saying Fish Creek or Beaver Creek or whatever, you know. So they try to specify names that are not offensive to native people, as well as actually better fitting to the local geographic history of the place.
And you have a link to Professor Gradwall, David Gradwall. You were one of his students, I believe.
Yes. In 91, I started my master's degree in anthropology with David as my major professor. And I've known him since then as a friend and professor, mentor, teacher.
Yeah.
And so we've had a long history. And at that time, actually, it was a topic of conversation in the Indian students.
It was about in the early 90s when this...
The one kind of taking the lead at that time was Fawn Steuben. Fawn Steuben, daughter of Jerry Steuben, who is a professor of political science there, Iowa State. So Fawn's hearing about this too, the work so long ago that she started as a young woman has kind of come to fruition.
Did you feel that this day would come?
You know, no. I know that it's... You have to get approval of everybody for these kind of things. And it's a topic of discussion. And now in these politicized times, whereas once most people were like, oh, okay, yeah. Now it's everything is a bone of contention for people. So there's still some people who think it's, not important or PC or whatever. And hopefully our little discussion today will at least help them understand a different point of view.
Yes, it is. That was the opportunity I was striving for for those that are always feeling so put upon that we're trying to be politically correct or whatever term you want to use. But this seems to go beyond that. This seems to be in an area of why would you impose a negative derogatory slur on a whole segment of our culture that we're essentially here to honor these natural resources. So any thoughts along those lines of why this is particularly important now?
I can kind of give you an overview and maybe help people see what's going on there. First of all, a lot of people say, what's the deal with that? It's just honoring Native American women and stuff because there's, it's an Indian word and stuff. Well, first of all, there's no such thing as Indian language. Some Indian languages are as different from each other as English is from Chinese. So, for example, our Iowa and Oto and Ho-Chunk or Winnebago people, we don't have that word in our language at all. We don't know what squaw is meaningless in the Iowa language. We call women Hinaka. Hinaka doesn't sound anything like squaw. The term squaw seems to have come from one of the language Algonquian family languages way up in the northeast part of the United States hundreds and hundreds of years ago. It's not used as a term for woman in even any of the Algonquian languages in Iowa, for example, Meskwaki and Sauk and those folks, Potawatomi, they have an Algonquian language, and that doesn't mean a woman in their language either. It is derived from a number of languages. And in some languages, that term means a woman's private parts. And so that's on one level. That's why you wouldn't want to call something genital creak, you know. I mean, you just wouldn't want to do that. It's just, you know. But on top of that, there's another layer that people don't understand. So usually when you hear the words like squaw, people think it's pretty innocuous. But for Indian people, it has the same context as the N-word for Black folks. It is used back in the day when people would call Indian men, they call them bucks, you know, like they're an animal or something.
Yeah.
And so the thing is, it's kind of like making people into animals. Fish Creek, Beaver Creek, Squaw Creek. So it's kind of like, and the other thing is, our women have all their lives, especially if you live around the reservation where there are racial tensions, have had white people. Oh, my grandmother even said people would call her, "Oh, you dirty squaw." You know, any word of itself is neutral, but it's how it's used over time that it is as a certain use. Like, for example, white folks don't have that kind of thing. I would say even words like hillbilly or redneck, for some, it's a badge of honor. You know, it's kind of like, yeah, that's my culture, man.
Yeah.
But no white person I know, what they get mad at is if you call them a loser or a deplorable or something. That's when their dander gets up.
Yeah.
You know, we can see how those words have really set off. But think about if you've been called deplorable for hundreds of years, and you say, you're nothing but a drunk deplorable, you're nothing but a dirty deplorable, you know, then that word deplorable, which at one time may have had a different meaning, becomes something harmful and makes you not a human being. So that's some of the issues there.
Are there other issues that you'd like to weave in concerning, well, the women disappearing from settlements and from reservations?
The missing and murdered Indigenous women, yes. The rates of the missing, and especially around some of the pipelines, that was one of the big issues around pipelines, was the fact that women disappeared or found later murdered around the man camps. Right, and then in the human trafficking, the prostitution rings and stuff that's been going on, all these are Indigenous women have suffered a much higher rate. Most other, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but their numbers are real high. And everybody knows somebody who's been murdered or has gone away and you never see them again. That started with even the settler trails here in Kansas. We have a mission that we're in the middle of acquiring a historic mission. And a lot of the kids were stolen by families traveling to Oregon and California, either as workers or companions to their own children, and they just were never seen again. One story of a girl who came back as an adult, all her family had been wiped out by cholera, and she went crazy.
So the dehumanization, unfortunately, is still manifesting in other ways beyond just the words. So in your authority as the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer, when were the Iowa people essentially asked to leave Iowa?
Well, that had been a slow process. We had actually been as far up as the Twin Cities up until about 1700. And with the movement of the settlers across the United States, there was almost like a domino effect where tribes were moving further and further west. That's how the Sac and Fox and the Potawatomi and stuff ended up into Iowa, too. They were being moved from their original lands. So they bumped into us, and we had been wiped out pretty much by various epidemics and stuff. So we ended up moving further and further south and southwest in Iowa. Iowaville, down by along the Des Moines River, that was our last big village up until the 1700s. Our last treaty that surrendered our lands in Iowa was in 1838. By the Treaty of 1836, we were removed to a reservation that we live at today, here in right across the river from St. Joe, Missouri.
You have preservation work ongoing?
We do. The Tribal Historic Preservation Officer, we're responsible for environmental compliance reviews, like whether building a project, whether it's going to affect one of our sites or our burials, things like that. And I do that. But since the fall of 2019, I've also been vice chairman. I was elected vice chairman. So that work has focused a lot over the last year on the pandemic and some of the economic issues we've experienced because of the flooding and the pandemic.
So there will be a new education center that will be opening and open to visitation to learn more about these important topics?
everything's closed right now because of the pandemic. Our effort right now is going on. We declared Iowa Tribal National Park as the second tribal national park in the United States. Currently, it's the largest one.
In case you just tuned in, you've been listening in to a conversation between Pat Schlarbaum and Lance Foster, Tribal Heritage Preservation Officer of the Iowa Tribe, responding to the newly named Iowa Creek.
And today we will be discussing Maria Pearson, a mother and a member of the Turtle Clan of the Yankton Nation of the Dakota people. Maria enjoyed many friends around the world and here in Ames, where she made her home until her passing from leukemia during the Memorial Day weekend in 2003. We will be speaking with Dr. David Gradwall, an emeritus professor of anthropology at Iowa State University, Mr. Jerome Thompson, state curator of historic sites and director of the Iowa Historical Museum, Ms. Irma White of the Winnebago of Nebraska Nation, and Chris Atkins, naturalist with the Dallas County Conservation Board. Maria Pearson grew up on the banks of the Missouri River near Greenwood, South Dakota, as a member of the Yankton Sioux Nation. She married John Pearson, who worked for the Iowa Department of Transportation at Marney, Iowa, in Cass County, and later moved to Ames in the 1970s. It was during this era that Maria became noted for her guidance concerning Native American remains. When a pioneer cemetery was unearthed, procedures varied between Native American remains and Euro-American or pioneer remains. Here is Dr. David Gradwall.
Welcome to Local Talk.
Glad to be here.
Let's talk about you in Ames just for a few moments. When did you come to Ames?
Came to Ames right out of grad school in 1962. Got a job at Iowa State University. I did have some other offers too, but I wanted to come back to the Midwest. My wife and I had grown up in Lincoln, Nebraska, and my primary interest was plains anthropology, so that fit quite well.
You followed your love of the Midwest, and we're fortunate to have you with us.
I am very fortunate to have been able to spend my career here.
And part of that was looking at the Native community.
Yes, I'm an archaeologist, but to me, if archaeology doesn't relate to real living people in some way, it's not worth much. There are, of course, close connections we can make with some archaeological complexes. With most, they're too far back in the past that we don't know.
What was it like meeting Maria Pearson?
Well, it was very interesting. Now, I first became aware of her in 1971 when the Glenwood controversy was in the newspapers. They were doing salvage archaeology over near the Missouri River near Glenwood, Iowa. And they ran across, superimposed into a Nebraska phase earth lodge that would date, let's say, around 1200 AD. And that was of interest because that culture is the one that I did my dissertation on at Harvard. And they found, intersecting into that earth lodge pit, burials, some 20 or 24, I forget exactly how many, Euro-Americans buried in coffins. And then a Native American woman in a flex position.
Flex is?
Kind of a fetal position.
Okay.
So Maria was very upset that they had reburied immediately without study the Euro-American skeletons. But they had brought the skeleton of the Native American young woman back to the archaeology lab in Iowa City for a scientific study. I was shocked because I've always described myself as an equal opportunity excavator. With the National Park Service contracts in Sailorville and Red Rock, we did excavate some Native American burials that were going to be destroyed in those reservoirs with permission and funding from the National Park Service. But we also had excavated an early Euro-American pioneer cemetery. So I felt I was an equal opportunity excavator. And so I discussed the issue in class. I thought it was very interesting that nobody cared about the white, the Euro-American pioneer skeletons. It seems to me that if those individuals were lost, if their names weren't known and nothing about them, that they ought to study them scientifically. Mm-hmm. And be equal, either study them all or rebury them all immediately. And my option would be, you know, to study them all. So I had followed the Glenwood controversy very closely and with great interest, because the first time I met her was in 1975. We had an American Indian symposium on campus, and we intentionally had a panel on the reburial controversy. And I had invited Maria Pearson to join us. I'd never met her. And she accepted the invitation, and I was standing in line when the conference began, and I hear this voice behind me saying, "I'm Maria Pearson, the governor's liaison on Indian affairs." And she said it with great authority. And I turned around, and here is this strikingly good-looking woman in a blue flannel suit and wearing a very beautiful beaded medallion. So I just turned around and I said, "I'm David Gradwell. I'm an archaeologist, one of those people you don't like. But we're really happy to have you here at our symposium." And she laughed, and she had a sense of humor, and so did I. Mm-hmm. And as the years went on, we became close associates working on reburial and repatriation issues, and became close personal friends. She did many things during her life, but she felt compelled, and part of it by her grandmother, who spoke to her through the rustling cottonwood leaves and at other times, to stand up for her people. And so she took a stand. Now, this was, you know, following a bit on the heels of the Black Power and the Red Power movements, when minority people felt empowered to speak out. So she did it within that context, but it took a lot of courage, because for many times, many years, she sort of stood up alone.
How did it go at that first meeting then?
That panel was very good. There were different opinions expressed. Nobody got mad at each other, but it was a civil conversation. And I think it led to part of archaeologists seeing and recognizing, at least here in Iowa, that there were ethical issues involved in digging up burials.
On a practical sense, and I think it was her husband, John Pearson, who said something happened today that is going to make you pretty upset.
Yes, John Pearson worked for the Highway Commission, and he found out about the Glenwood discoveries through his contact with archaeologists who were working with the Department of Transportation. And that's when Maria put on her best regalia and went into Governor Ray's office and demanded her people's bones back. She told this story often, and I did get her to put it into a tape recorder. I transcribed it and reworked it, and it's in the revised edition of The World's Between Two Rivers, published by the University of Iowa Press.
Well, that'd be something very enlightening to include in our website then also.
Yes, I think so.
As we learn more about this major person of the Ames community. So from the meeting with Governor Ray, that the grievances were aired, and do you recall the outcome of that meeting?
Well, first of all, Governor Ray asked his adjutant, "Do we have her people's bones?" But he pursued it, and I think Governor Ray has a real compassion for cross-cultural matters, bringing in the Southeast Asians and everything. So I think he was a very sympathetic person to these different causes. And ultimately, the bones were studied at the Office of the State Archaeologist in Iowa City, and then they were reburied. And in 1976, the Iowa Burial Code was changed, largely due to the efforts of Maria Pearson, working with archaeologist, and I'm really proud to have been an archaeologist working in Iowa, because I think the professional community here responded, I think, first with shock, but then with understanding. And we have had, ever since, excellent relationships with Native Americans here in Iowa on not just going out and digging up Indian burials without a cause, and if they are encountered accidentally, then Native Americans are consulted with. And usually the Native Americans here in Iowa are more than reasonable. They say, well, if you can't avoid that particular construction project, then excavate them, study them, and rebury them. This was not the case across the country. We anticipated here in Iowa in 1976 the Native American Grave and Repatriation Act, the federal act, which wasn't passed until 1990 or 91. So we were the forerunners there, and I think ethically we were definitely on the wrong side, but I have to tell you, many of our archaeological and physical anthropological colleagues across the country accused us of selling out.
I've also heard, though, that Maria Pearson changed the world.
Well, in many respects, she did. There were others then that came along and were working with her, but she not only addressed the matter nationally through the Society for American Archaeology, the American Anthropological Association, and so forth, where she gave presentations, but she did it on an international scale, particularly working with Larry Zimmerman in the World Congress of Archaeology.
Is there anything else that...
You know, when anthropologists work with other people, whether they're indigenous or not, there's sort of a relationship between the scientist or observer and the person who's providing the information. But I never expected, because it isn't typical, that a person you're working with in that relationship would particularly care about your opinions or practices, because you are the scientist and they are the person being studied. But she didn't view it that way. So we had discussions on Native American religions and Catholicism, because she was involved in the Catholic Church. And I'm not sure that she had ever talked extensively to a person of Jewish faith, which I am. And so we had ongoing discussions, and there were some points of similarity, but I would call them parallelisms, between Judaism and Native American practices. And I used to always tell her, now, Maria, don't tell anybody about this, because they already think Native Americans are the lost tribes of Israel. And I'm from the tribe that did not get lost. But I was particularly touched when Maria went on a peace mission to Israel and Jordan and brought me back a yarmulke, a skull cap, as a present. And I thought it was very touching, first of all, that she would bring me back anything, and secondly, that she would bring me a skull cap, which I had never bought since my family are followers of Reform Judaism, or the more liberal branch, and wearing the yarmulke is optional, and I opt not to wear one.
She was thinking of you.
She was thinking of me. She was a very loyal friend. She also could state her opinion if she thought you were wrong. She also listened, however, in the case of the Northridge burial, right here in Ames.
When was the disturbance? 90.
This was 1991.
91. Mm-hmm.
A burial mound had been discovered, what looked like a burial mound. The geomorphologist did a soil test, and they not only found a human-made soil profile, but their probe struck some bone. So there's a big controversy about what was going to happen there. I was asked to go out and investigate the situation, and I decided that whoever was buried there, that was a burial mound, had started their spirit journey there And it was my opinion that that person or person should continue their spirit journey where their survivors had placed them. And I made that, that was my recommendation. I knew that it was basically the decision of the Indian Advisory Board, which Maria chaired, and our state archaeologist at the time, Bill Green. And I knew Bill Green would stand solidly behind us. That case, incidentally, went all the way to the Supreme Court. The realtors had brought suit, and the courts found for the Native Americans in that case that that was a pre-existing condition, the burial, and that it could not be disturbed, and that the archaeologist did not have to give the realtors any compensation for the fact that that building lot would not be built upon. So then I was hired by the realtors, who I think weren't happy that we were finding things there. Maria told me, she said, well, rather than be afraid of Gradwell, you know, have him do it because, you know, you need to know whether there's anything there or not. And if it's there, he'll tell you. So my students went out. I was recovering from surgery at the time and couldn't be in the field for any extensive time. And they found a second burial, not in a mound, but someone whose grave had been dug into those beautiful bluffs up above the creek there. So then there was this controversy of what to do. Again, that area was prohibited from construction. Shirley Shermer from the Office of the State Archaeologist came up and said, yes, that they were human bones. I was glad to know that my analysis was correct, but Shirley is the expert in that area. And their question was what to do. They could have reburied those in one of the four reburial cemeteries in Iowa. And again, my suggestion was, well, whatever it is, this person started his spirit journey there. And so Maria trusted me and a graduate student, Jeff Berland, to do the reburial. We went to her house. She instructed us to make some tobacco offerings, stitched in red cloth, and even with my pathetic sewing skill, I could do that. And we went to her house, and she smudged us. She purified us
with sweetgrass. Uh-huh.
The smoke. She instructed us to put some sage behind our ear when we went there, and exactly what to do, and to do it, and then come back and report to her what we had done. And again, I can't tell you the gratefulness I had that she trusted us to do that. She did not like to be around burials and certainly didn't want to handle the bones. But, you know, professionally that is something we do. But she trusted us to do the right thing. And I have to tell you, one of my colleagues said to me, well, did you really, you know, put the sage behind your ear? And I said, of course, why wouldn't I? When I go into an Orthodox synagogue, I put a head covering on. And when I go into a Buddhist shrine or a Muslim house of worship, I take off my shoes. Those are just common courtesies in observing what is appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else, Dr. Gradwell?
I could tell Maria stories on and on and on, but I think this sort of gives a profile of this remarkable person who you're fortunate enough to know and who lived in Ames and is a part of our local history as well as state and national history.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure, and I appreciate your doing this program on Maria.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio, and today we're talking about Maria Pearson, a mother a member of the Turtle Clan of the Yankton Nation, and friend to many around the world, and here in Ames, where she made her home in the 1970s. Another compatriot of Maria Pearson is Jerome Thompson. He grew up in Ames and wanted to be included in presenting Maria Pearson's life to you, our listeners.
Welcome to Local Talk, Jerome Thompson.
Good morning.
And your position here at the historical building?
With the State Historical Society, my current position is state curator, and I'm also administrator of our historic sites. First time I met Maria was at the Toolsboro Mounds National Historic Landmark site in Loisa County, which was one of the sites I was responsible for. And that would have been in probably 1984. I'd started here in 83 in the fall, and then in the spring I was doing a site visit and discovered that some ground disturbance, probably from a groundhog or, you know, something like that, had gotten into one of the mounds.
And that site is overlooking the Mississippi.
Right, down in Loisa County. And Maria made a site visit there, along with Shirley Shermer, who is director of the burials program, who recently retired with the Iowa Office of the State Archaeologist, to sort of advise me on how best to make repairs to the mound disturbance. See, Iowa, and of course Maria is largely responsible for this, was one of the first states in the country to establish a Native American Burials Protection Act, which is part of Iowa law. And, you know, in the early 1970s, actually when I was a student at Iowa State, you know, there was, you know, quite a bit of movement with the American Indian movement for looking at Native American rights. The State Museum, in the 1960s, there had been a burials excavated out in West Des Moines at what is now a retirement home. And the museum staff at that time were following pretty much standard museum practice or archaeological practice. They went out and there were a number of the burials where they encased them in plaster jackets and did partial excavation. They moved them to the museum and put them on display. And then in the early 1970s, there was action that was, we don't exhibit your ancestors' bones, why are you doing it with ours? And that dynamic, that tension between what was viewed as, you know, scientific inquiry versus cultural sensitivity had not quite come to the point where it exists today.
There was growth and development culturally.
It took decades. Actually, before the Federal Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act of 1990, Iowa was basically working where human remains that were in the museum's collection or any place in the state would go to the state archaeologist, to the burials program, and through Maria's efforts and Dwayne Anderson, who was later state archaeologist, they established four reburial grounds in around the state in the four cardinal directions, so that, you know, those remains that were could be documented to be found in a particular area would go to one of those cemeteries for reburial. What changed in 1990 was the federal law. And that federal law required that all museums or institutions that receive federal funding, which would include colleges and universities, if they had human remains in those collections, they were to inventory them and share those culturally affiliated tribes, or, and that was the process where, you know, I worked with Maria and the State Archaeologist's Office for repatriation and reburial of some of the human remains that had been in the State Historical Society's collections.
Were there any specific stories or good example of that cooperative working relationship?
Well, the Blood Run National Historic Landmark site, which is up in Lyon County in northwest Iowa, Maria was very influential. We acquired portions of that property in 1986, and because there is a Dakota, Omaha, a number of tribes called that home up in the 1600s, 1700s, and Maria came to bat on a couple of occasions when there were graveling operations and other kinds of things that were potentially threatening parts of the site that even weren't owned by the state. Of course, now that particular site in South, it's in both Iowa and South Dakota. South Dakota State Parks just dedicated the Good Earth at Blood Run site in South mm-hmm. Dakota. And the Iowa Department of Natural Resources Parks Bureau has received funding to begin doing some master planning for the Iowa portions of that particular site.
Some of that early work from the 80s then is still carrying on.
Oh, absolutely.
And so her influence is,
yep.
is
and,
certainly
you know,
being
there are different people, you know, some people yeah. who may or may not have known Maria, but they've all known her probably by reputation, who are involved with their own tribal historic yeah. preservation officers, would want to attribute some of that influence to Maria's work. She was yeah. well known. Well, you know, Maria's story is an important Iowa story. And mm-hmm. Even in one of our children's publications in the 1990s, Maria Pearson was stated as one of those influential Iowa women.
Exactly.
You know, just anecdotally, I think it was about 1989, I was invited out to do a program for the staff at the Pennsylvania Historical Museum Commission in Harrisburg. And after that staff meeting, I got a tour of the Pennsylvania State Museum. And in one of the galleries, there was this exhibition that was dealing with highway archaeology. Interesting topic. And then in a display in which, you know, you could see diorama background kinds of things of construction activities and an archaeologist with a, you know, transit out there shooting levels and whatnot. There was this area that was actually excavated in the floor and covered in glass, and it was a human burial that had been moved into the museum. And because of Maria's influence, those types of things went off exhibition in Iowa in the 1970s, and here probably about almost 15 years later, the practice was still happening in a Pennsylvania museum. And I asked the curator colleague, said, you know, does this create any distress among, you know, any of the Native American community here? And he goes, no, because they're all out west. I was kind of dumbstruck by that particular comment and just let it go. It definitely influenced a, you know, at least ways in my world in historic preservation and historic site preservation, definitely changed, you know, how we look at things and how we move forward where when interpreting, you know, a culture that is not mine.
And that influence is still being realized, it sounds. Yeah. Well, thank you for that. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Trevor Thompson.
Good to see you.
Yes, sir.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and as we draw to the end of the hour, we have a little change of pace. We're happy that Leanne Harder can be with us again today. Hi, Leanne. Welcome back.
We have Leanne Harder with us again. We missed the whole month of February without a report. So you're here right on the very second day of March. That sounds strange. It's not particularly windy. I don't know whether that means anything or not.
Well, hopefully it will be a calm month and maybe we can have a really beautiful spring. I think we all deserve that. Over the past couple of years.
Yes, I think we do too.
I'm looking forward to seeing the flowers coming up out of the ground.
Oh, it's almost impossible for me to imagine that.
Yeah, well, since I did miss a month of February, I do want to go back and provide some updates for all your listeners for some of the awards of grant funding that the Board of Supervisors did at the end of January. I've talked about the Board of Supervisors and the fact that they are receiving funds through the American Rescue Plan Act. Those funds are about $19 million. The American Rescue Plan Act, of course, is the funding that was approved by Congress in 2021 for the communities throughout the nation to help communities and everyone begin to respond to economic recovery for COVID-19. Story County did receive some of that funding in 2021, and we anticipate receiving the other half in 2022. In response to receiving those funds, the Board of Supervisors decided to open it up to communities, organizations, and external partners to submit proposals for funding consideration. That happened last October and fall, and after receiving 37 applications, as well as applications from various county offices and departments for the potential use of the funds, the board held several public work sessions to discuss how the projects were eligible in accordance with the interim guidelines from the United States Department of Treasury. On Tuesday, January 25th, 2022, the Board of Supervisors did review the projects along with proposed funding amounts and deemed projects eligible based on the final guidelines that we had received from the United States Treasury Department. The board acted to preliminarily approve projects and directed staff to begin the process of developing contracts and appropriate documents. Of that money that Story County anticipates receiving, the board approved nearly $11 million in funding for some specific areas. The first one is water quality and wastewater projects, and the board has preliminarily approved about $4.3 million to several communities throughout Story County for projects in those areas. The next area is projects addressing negative economic impacts related to COVID-19, related to housing, food insecurity, child care, and other social services. For those areas, about $4.6 million has been awarded. And then funds have also been awarded for public health response. And that's about $2 million for safety and accessibility of county operations. Then also in previous board action, the board did partner with the Ames Chamber Foundation for some workforce training initiatives, retraining initiatives. So in all, with all the projects thus far, the board has approved over $11.6 million. If you are curious in finding out more information about the individual projects and the amounts that have been awarded preliminarily, you can look at the county's website. Go to storycountyiowa.gov, click on the Board of Supervisors tab under Government, and look for the American Rescue Plan Act on your left. Or you can call 515-382-7200, which is the Board of Supervisors office. I do want to just note that there's a public hearing to set the maximum property tax levy scheduled for next Tuesday, March 8th at 10 a.m. Annually, the Board of Supervisors does need to hold a public hearing to set the total maximum property tax levy. They are planning for fiscal year 2023 budget. That fiscal year begins on July 1st, 2022 and ends June 30th, 2023. Additional information about the county's proposed maximum property tax levy is also available on the county's website, and that public hearing will be held in the second floor public meeting room in Story County Administration Building in Nevada. Just an invitation that for a board and commission opening, we have opening for volunteers interested in serving on the Commission of Veterans Affairs. We actually have two openings. Persons interested in serving on that Commission of Veterans Affairs can look at our website for the application for appointment. Contact me and I can get to you as well. There's also some additional information about that board and commission as well as others. I'm going to do a shout out to Paul if he's listening, because this is when I make him cry every year, at least once or twice a year. The annual property tax reminder, it's March. And so the Story County Treasurer's Office is reminding property owners that taxes are due March 31st. So you can pay your property taxes online at iowatreasures.org. You can mail payments to Post Office Box 498 in Nevada, or you can come to the Treasurer's Office in person at the Story County Administration Building Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. There's also a drop box outside of the building. Along with our budget and maximum property tax levy, We're looking at our capital improvements plan. We do that annually as part of the budget. We have a draft capital improvements plan for public feedback out right now on our website. Copies have been sent to city halls and libraries as well. Our CIP is a multi-year guide to construction and improvement of county facilities and the acquisition of equipment. It's a planning tool that's structured to highlight Story County's long-range capital needs, and projects are organized by equipment and just new projects such as building, land acquisition, remodels, and items costing over $25,000. You can find that draft CIP on our county's website. Again, go to government and then the Board of Supervisors, and you'll see stuff, a tab on the left for capital improvements planning. You can submit comments online or contact me and get me your comments. We say this every month I do. We want you to be out and about Story County. If you take a picture of a site that's a favorite photo of Story County, send it to us and we can feature it on our social media. You can send it to storycountyis85@gmail.com to be featured. You can also reach us by signing up for Notify Me. Follow us on our social media on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is Story County, Iowa. And then lastly, you can contact me at lharder@storycountyiowa.gov, or my phone number is 515-382-7247. And again, our website is www.storycountyiowa.gov. And as I say every month, I am so appreciative to KHOI for this ongoing partnership. And I will talk to everyone again in April.
Thanks. I want you to know that Paul Wearson, who used to be my co-host,
had a stroke several months ago, and so he hasn't been with us. But he's staying with friends in Story City and looking forward to getting back out to the farm. But he always looks forward to interviewing Leanne, so he wants to make sure she knows he's...
I know breeze is fresh and the cold winds blow around me. Let there be that big blue sky, let that eagle fly right on by over me. Set my spirit free, let my soul drift away. Hear what that goddess in the breeze has to say. Down by the river. up on the ridge.
Thinking of her.
And, yep. But he's doing very well, and he especially wanted to say hello to Leanne.
I wish nothing but the best for Paul, and when I see him in person again, I will bring a Kleenex box with me.
Well, I that's one of the good things about being at home and unable to go out any place. He has a Kleenex box handy when you're telling him about the taxes. So thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. And I hope everyone does have a great March and stay safe and weather aware. We're still in winter time.
Thank you. Bye. Bye.
Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other artists you heard was Big Blue Sky, The River I Know. Stay tuned for Headline News and Democracy Now! Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you'd like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come and join the Local Talk team. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. So thank you for listening, and
see you again on the radio.